Hi, this is Jerry DiPiano, and you are listening to the Love Mia Vita podcast. Today I'm with my co-host, Dr. Catherine Sharif. Dr. Sharif is a professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, and she is also an advisor to Femme Pharma Consumer Healthcare. Catherine, did I miss anything?
No, you didn't.
So today's podcast is an important one, especially for those women who have hit an important milestone, 40. We always say that age is just a number and 40 is not old. But there are things we ought to be thinking about once we hit that important milestone, because some people refer to it as midlife. I prefer to think of midlife as 50, but some folks like to think about it as 40, so we'll call 40 approaching midlife. And there are certain considerations that women should be thinking about, but their healthcare practitioners also need to be having these conversations. And since Dr. Sharif is both a primary care practitioner but has deep knowledge of women's healthcare and has been involved extensively in the treatment of women for different conditions that they experience throughout their reproductive aging, she is the best person to have this conversation. So, Catherine, what is it that healthcare practitioners ought to be thinking about when a patient, a woman of 40, shows up in their office?
One of the first things that we think of when a woman who's 40 shows up is we think about screening and tests. And that's because mammograms traditionally start at age 40. So it's the best test that we have right now to detect breast cancer. And one thing to keep in mind is that mammograms don't prevent breast cancer, but the idea is early detection, hopefully to pick up things while they're still small. So when we think about screening, not only do we think about mammograms, which actually start at 40, but also pap smears, which after age 35, if they've been normal, you can get them done every 5 years. The other thing we think about near age 40 is screening colonoscopy for colon cancer, which is now starts at age 45, and we've heard rumors that the starting age for screening might even start earlier at age 40, because colon cancer is showing up more and more in young people. So first is the screening tests, and your doctor will discuss with you, should you get a mammogram every year or every year or two? Should you wait till 45 and so on? Of course, if you have breast cancer in the family, you might start sooner. So that discussion may have started sooner. Other things we think about traditionally when women are age 40 is we start thinking about menopause and perimenopause. So, as you know, the average age of menopause in this country is age 50. And the definition of menopause is 1 year since your last menstrual period. But that doesn't mean that everything is exactly the same all the way up to age 40. And you can start having perimenopausal symptoms in your 40s or even in your late 30s. Some of those symptoms may include mood changes, hot flashes, change in vaginal secretions. So we think about perimenopause.
Well, we if we can go back to some of the diagnostic testing, and thank you for sharing with us some of the confusion that may exist with respect to things like mammograms and pap smears and so forth. And as your healthcare practitioner, if you, for example, have a woman who's come in and she is doing breast self-examinations, you say, well, I don't think I need a mammogram. Or on the alternative is a woman who is paranoid because, and rightfully so, because she has very dense breasts. Is there something more when we think about diagnosis specifically on the breast and breast conditions? How should one be thinking about that?
Yes, so When you have a mammogram that shows that you have very dense breasts, and what that really means is lots of tissue and not so much fat. So as we get older, the tissue in our breasts is replaced by fat. Fat is relatively easy to x-ray. If you x-ray a pile of fat, you just see black. And if there's lots of tissue, it's all this white, dense stuff and squiggly lines. And so something may be abnormal, or maybe you just can't see anything at all. And that's usually when radiology asks us to send our patients back with an order for an ultrasound. And so we can ultrasound specific areas.
And if you're a woman who's doing breast self-exams, and let's be honest, even some of the gynecologists that are out there don't do the breast exam the same way. There's different methods to doing breast exams. We know because we've run clinical trials for fibrocystic breast condition, and we had to standardize on what the method was. But if you're a woman doing a breast self-exam, that isn't enough.
No, it isn't enough. And if something is big enough for you to feel, that is big. Okay. We would like to be able to pick up breast cancer when it's the size of, say, a little piece of uncooked rice or even smaller. But what we don't want to do is pick it up when it's bigger. And the smaller the masses, the easier it is, the better the prognosis. So that's why I would not rely on breast exam alone.
Then the third test that you just or second test that you described was the Pap smear. And I know there's been a lot of confusion from women. I'm in a monogamous relationship. I don't think I need to have a Pap smear. I understand that the requirements have changed. Can you give us a little bit more context on that?
Sure. So I've heard from patients often that they suspect that the Pap smear is every 5 years because the insurance company wants to save money. And well, there's no question that insurance companies want to save money. However, Pap smears don't cost very much. And so the rationale for getting them every 5 years is this. In the 50s and 60s, the Norwegian countries started keeping a database of women and Pap smears. And what they found, so women would have a Pap smear every year, and we would pick up abnormal cells. Once we were able to detect the human papillomavirus, which is what causes cervical cancer, they kept track of how often women needed Pap smears. And what it looks like in almost 99% of cases is if you get the human papillomavirus and you don't do anything about it and your body doesn't deal with it, and it persists, it takes you about 10 years to get cervical cancer. And so in some places, Pap smears are recommended for every 10 years. But in the US, we recommend every 5 years. And so it works like this. Let's say I have a Pap smear today, and the cells are normal, and the human papillomavirus was not detected. That's great. Now, let's say I go out tomorrow and acquire the human papillomavirus. And let's say my immune system doesn't kill it, and it's going around and creating problems, abnormal cells. I will not get cervical cancer for 10 years. And I will be getting a Pap smear in 5 more years. So, in other words, we don't expect people to fall through the cracks.
That's good advice. And I guess along those same lines, more recently, I believe it was in the 90s, we were, I guess, pleased to find out that there was a vaccine. It's called Gardasil. And so if you're a younger woman, your parent probably had you immunized with the Gardasil vaccine. But when is it too late to get Gardasil?
Well, it's never too late to get Gardasil. I wish we could give Gardasil to women in their 60s, right? Because You can actually pick up the human papillomavirus in your 60s the same way you did in your 20s, right? So insurance, at first, they only covered it for children and young women in their 20s and not after age 26. Now I believe they will cover it up to age 40 or 45. And I wish they would cover it for more, because you know what else human papillomavirus causes? Throat cancer, right? So people are more likely to have oral cancer these days than they did when we were growing up. And if that, and there is more, we know that there's a higher incidence now of oral cancer, throat cancer, due to the human papillomavirus, and we have no way of screening for it. So if you have the virus, you would be protected. I mean, the vaccine.
Good to know. It's good to know, because there are probably some 40-somethings that are listening to this, and possibly some 30-somethings. So it's not too late. Probably a good idea. Do your pap test. Also ask about, since HPV is transmissible through a variety of routes, better to ask about getting immunized, getting vaccinated with the Gardasil vaccine. So good information. Obviously, we're learning more about colon cancer. If you have a first degree relative that has colon cancer, we know that colon cancer is affecting younger individuals these days, surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, as we've chatted about this in previous podcasts. Yeah. But if you have a first degree relative that's had colon cancer, what should you be
what
doing?
So first degree would be mother, father, sister, brother, right? And whatever age they had colon cancer, you should get screened at least 10 years before that. Because it takes, you know, a while for these polyps to grow and to become malignant. So we want to snip it. And so if it used to be that we would screen people when they were older, but now, because they're getting so so many younger people are having colon cancer, you might get screened in your 20s and 30s. If you had a relative, a mother, father, sister, brother with colon cancer at 40, you would be screened at 30.
So as a healthcare practitioner, you would have taken this history, and you would hopefully, your patient is going to share this kind of information, but you would ask all of these questions for sure. And that would be one of the questions. So if the first degree relative was say 40, when they were diagnosed, and you show up and you're 35 and you haven't had your screening, that's probably something you're going to recommend.
Right
away. So talking about the midlife, as a 40-year-old, you're going to have that screening in any event, and it would be heightened. That screening necessity for screening would be heightened if, as you say, there would be a first degree relative. So we have the screening, we have the background information. What are some of the other things that you would do or ask your patient? And we're talking largely about, actually exclusively about women.
Yes. So I would ask them about menstrual periods, and women pay very close attention to their periods. Even if they don't use a calendar or an app to track the days, they usually know it looks like this. It starts with a little bit of red blood, then it gets heavier the next day, then it does this. And they know their periods very well. So I ask people, has your menstrual period changed in the last year or so? And that is because they may get alarmed that there are changes, and it's actually normal to have changes. So our estrogen and progesterone start to go down at 30 or around 35 on average. And when estrogen and progesterone get lower, the pattern changes. So some women are alarmed because of the change in the pattern. But I reassure them that this is just part of this long transition up to 50, to when your periods stop.
So it's part of reproductive aging. And there are lots of studies which look at, or I should say, there are a number of studies that look at reproductive aging and what those transition periods start to look like. We need to provide more education both to the healthcare practitioner and also to the woman. And let's face it, you're a primary care practitioner with a substantial knowledge of women's health and more broadly, and think about this more globally than other providers, which is not to be disrespectful to other primary care practitioners. But imagine if your primary care practitioner isn't asking you these questions. So this is information that can be helpful in that conversation, which should be bi-directional. So when you go to your healthcare practitioner, this information that we're sharing with you now is helpful both to the person who is the professional, but also to the woman who may need to put these questions down and to try to get some answers. Prepare yourself, because your HCP is a busy person, probably seeing 30 plus patients per day. So if you show up armed with these types of questions, it's likely that you will be able to get the answers that you're looking for, at least some answers, as opposed to if you just wander in and expect that your HCP is going to spend 2 hours with you writing a book.
That's right, right. Going through the book chapter by chapter.
Yes.
Yeah. Some other things to keep in mind is that even though we're not going to do a bone density scan or a DEXA scan, because we generally don't do that until age 65, we're still concerned about your bone health. And women reach their maximum bone density by approximately age 35, and then it's downhill after that. And so everything that you do today as a 40-year-old is in service of your 60 and your 80-year-old self. And the more weight-bearing exercise you do, the more walking you do, the less likely you are to fall and break a hip. And we know what happens when you break a hip. You enter the healthcare system, you end up in the hospital, you may get an infection, you may get a blood clot, and on and on and on for the next year until you may die. So women who get hip fractures die sooner. And it's not because there's something wrong with them. It's because of what the fracture does and how you get into the healthcare system.
Which is, it's also, it's an important consideration for us along a number of lines, because when you think about this, we do terrible things to ourselves when we're younger because we believe that we are invulnerable. And so one of the things that women may do is they may overexercise and undereat. They may experience disordered eating, which leads to anorexia and bulimia, and they end up becoming amenorrheic, or they stop having a menstrual cycle. That's another risk factor. And so if that's part of your history, perhaps you are recovered or recovering. If that's part of your history, what should women be thinking about at that point? Because maybe they haven't had a period for a couple of years.
Yes. So if you haven't had a period for a couple of years, if you've had an eating disorder, you really are at risk of osteoporosis, because you need nutrients to build bone. And if you're embarrassed about it or ashamed of it, please tell your clinician anyway, because they need to know, and you may be screened sooner.
And along those same lines, sometimes women are placed into chemical menopause. And I'm thinking about women who have endometriosis and have been taking medications. We're not going to name any, but they're taking medications which cause them to go into chemical menopause. So these are special populations of women.
Yes. So if you've been on one of these drugs that puts you in an early menopause and you were given it because you have endometriosis, That means your body really believes you're in menopause, you're not making estrogen, and your bones are going to become brittle at an earlier age, and you do need to be screened for osteoporosis.
So special populations, anytime you have stopped menstruating for chemical reasons, for surgical reasons, you are someone, if you show up at your HCP's office and she doesn't know that that you have been treated for this condition, I'm going to make sure that you share that information. So this is the bi-directional nature of that conversation, especially if it's a new HCP. If you were to visit Catherine for the very first time and you did not share that as part of your history, it's probably worthwhile to do that because she may not order that same test if she didn't know that, right?
That's right. That's right. I can, I completely understand when people have shame and embarrassment about certain things, eating disorders, abortions, drinking alcohol, but we really, really need to know so we can take good care of you. If you were a former smoker, we want to know because we can now do CAT scans of the lungs to look for early lung cancer, which is your best chance if you have lung cancer. I won't know unless you told me you were smoking.
So when you're filling out those forms, make sure you fill them out honestly.
That's right.
It doesn't help your doctor if you try to hide things.
That's right.
So we talked about bone density. We talked about the way in which we could screen for individuals that might have issues. We talked about some special populations. What's next?
Well, there are some things that I worry about that are not picked up, frequently overlooked, and that's sleep apnea in women. You don't have to be overweight to have sleep apnea. If you have sleep apnea for years, you are, you know, not only not sleeping well, and it makes it very easy to gain weight, but it also puts you at risk for heart failure. So I am concerned that women who don't sleep well will just brush it off to not sleeping well, or I'm anxious, or I've never slept well, or maybe this is menopause and this and that. And I do want you to mention it to your doctor.
So sleep is an issue that we all struggle with. I think that from time to time, and it could be that, you know, there are very obvious causes for the lack of sleep, such as you just had a baby and you're getting up every 2 or 3 hours with feedings, et cetera. Could be that you have a snoring partner that's keeping you up. But if that's not the case and you have always had issues with sleep, just don't chalk it off as insomnia and start taking some prescription medication that is recommended to you by a psychiatrist, because those are also habit forming. Better to figure out what the underlying causes are is what I'm hearing from you, Catherine, which has consequences, right? And the cardiovascular consequences are not insignificant.
I agree. And sometimes I think that sleep is just not taken that seriously, right? So we burn the candle at both ends. We go to bed late and get up early because we just have to get things done. And sleep is critical to our health, 7 to 9 hours a night, depending on who you are. For me, it's 9 hours a night, has been all my life. And it is, if you can't sleep, this is not a social problem and it's not an inconvenience. You need to see someone about it, not necessarily to get drugs to sleep, because drugs drug you and they don't necessarily help you sleep. They, you know, they just, you're drugged. So you need to see a sleep expert. And if you don't have sleep apnea, you might have something else. But whatever it is, there are psychologists who do cognitive behavioral therapy to help you to sleep, but you have to sleep. Your life really depends on it.
What about cardiovascular health? Should we, 40, you know, 40, again, we think we're young and invulnerable, but at 40, how worried should we be about the heart? And should your healthcare practitioner be asking questions about your cardiovascular or cardiometabolic health?
Sure. So things that put you at risk for future heart disease include high blood pressure. And we know that if your blood pressure goes from 120 over 80 to 140 over 80, you actually increase the risk of having a heart attack. So it's not insignificant. Every few points that you go up are harmful to your arteries. So elevated blood pressures, let's call it, we need to pay attention to that and figure out how can we get them down without using medication. Secondly, do you have elevated sugars? Do you have an elevated A1C, the 3-month sugar that many of us test for now? 6.5 and above is diabetes, 5.7 to 6.4 is pre-diabetes. I would say at least half of the women I see in the office are pre-diabetic, which is a huge number, and it didn't used to be like that. Another thing that puts you at risk, your family history. It's like colon cancer. Did anyone in your family have a heart attack, and was it at a younger age? Young age for a woman would be 55. Young age for a man would be 40, 45 or so. So those are risk factors for heart disease. And one thing, another thing is, do you have a high LDL cholesterol? So you know you have the total cholesterol number. I really don't find that helpful because it's the sum of the good cholesterol and the bad cholesterol, LDL, and the triglycerides divided by 5. So let's just say the sum of the good and the bad cholesterol. So your total cholesterol could be high because your good cholesterol is very high. But usually what it is that the LDL, the bad cholesterol, is high. Optimally, we'd like to see your LDL cholesterol as low as possible, say under 100. And if it's not, you may be right as we speak right now, you 40-year-old, you are taking those LDL particles and putting them up into the coronary arteries and starting to build plaque. And we have no way of knowing whether you're doing that or not. Chances are, if the LDL is lower, you are not doing that. Now, there's a test called the CT coronary calcium score, which is not paid for by insurance. And this is a CAT scan that's only 5 minutes, very little radiation. And it tells us, do you have calcium in your coronary arteries or not? Is your score 0 or is your score 1 or 100 or 200? If there is calcium in the coronary arteries, you have plaque, meaning you have taken, your body has taken the LDL, that high LDL, and deposited it into the arteries. And wherever that you form those plaques, calcium follows. And that's what we're detecting. That test runs around $100 or so. But it can also give you a false sense of security. If the test is normal and your calcium score is 0, but your LDL is 150 or 200, you probably still are building up plaque. So instead of taking a test, what I'd like you to do is to focus on what you can control. What is under your control? Your family history is not under your control. Your parents, I think for most of us, they are not under our control. However, you can control high sugars, elevated blood pressures, and high LDL cholesterol. And you can control that with diet and exercise.
And these are risk factors that we ought to be thinking about when we hit this magic age, and definitely beyond that, because there are, as you say, there are some interventions that are under our control that we need to be thinking about. This is part of the idea of prevention for symptoms becoming either exacerbation of symptoms or to begin to see more emergence of symptoms. And in women, in particular, as we age, right, our reproductive aging does have an impact on what happens to some of these conditions. So exacerbation of heart disease, exacerbation of potentially cardiometabolic syndrome, which includes things that we just discussed, like diabetes. And we know that diabetes also leads to problems with cardiovascular disease. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you fail to take some of these steps as a younger person when you potentially have the opportunity to forestall or prevent these from getting worse if they are pre-existing. And if they're not, then the prevention piece is actually even better, because then you can live your best life as you continue to, as that number continues to advance. So we all, the consequence of that is not good. So we all want to get older. We just want to get older and be healthier.
Yes. Yes. And you know, something to think about also is alcohol. And we've used more alcohol since the pandemic. And many women have told me how they're drinking more since then. And alcohol is so bad for you in so many ways. And, you know, I like a glass of wine on a Friday night as much as anyone else. But what you can't be doing is having two drinks per night. And so in the past, the teaching has been one drink a night is okay, or in other words, seven drinks a week total. And now even the American, the Cancer Society says that's probably too much. No alcohol is the best alcohol, or two to three drinks a week, and that's it. So alcohol actually breaks down into sugar. So it makes your sugars higher. It also is converted to triglycerides, which is one of the bad cholesterol types. I can tell when someone's drinking and when they're not, depending on how high their triglycerides go. Another thing is people say, I need it to sleep. But remember what I was saying about being drugged to sleep. So you drink alcohol. Let's say you were out, or you actually fall asleep at home. Good, you fell asleep. So why do you wake up a couple of hours later? Because the alcohol, the drug, wore off, and now you're wide awake. We also know that it increases estrogen, and more estrogen means more breast cancer. And when we look at large population studies, one of the risk factors for getting more breast cancer is higher alcohol consumption. So it's a shame.
Well, obviously, we have a lot of folks that are probably listening in and thinking, well, that's probably me, because we like to go out with our, you know, our companions and partners and so forth. And, you know, alcohol has become a cult phenomenon for decades. And we tend to think of it as harmless differently than we think about drugs, but it's still a drug, and it's a poison. Alcohol is a poison. So we have to think about it in the context of it is a poison. Even if we like it, it doesn't like us. And for all the reasons that you just mentioned, it probably is something that we should reserve for special occasions. And binge drinking, we know, is not good either. So reserving it for the weekend, but having, you know, a couple of bottles of wine on the weekend is probably also not in our best interest. You also had at one point during another one of our podcasts talked about fatty liver. And let's perhaps explore that. Is that something that you should be thinking about as you hit this midlife?
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned fatty liver, because we still are not used to thinking of it, how prominent it is, meaning, or how prevalent it is, how many people have it. So fatty liver used to only pretty much exist in people who were drinking alcohol. And when I started my practice in 1995, I only saw it in people who had what we called non-A, non-B hepatitis, which was hepatitis C at the time. And we saw it in people who drink too much. That out fatty liver now has gone from a very, very low prevalence to almost 30% of all Americans in this country. And it is related to weight gain, and it's also related to alcohol. And then the two of them make it worse. They compound it. So the number one reason to have a liver transplant in this country used to be liver cancer or hepatitis B, hepatitis C. Now, the number one reason that women get a liver transplant is fatty liver. Because if you have fat in there, whether it's from alcohol or from weight gain, it is so toxic to the liver that it's actually in, it injures the liver. And so you get scar tissue. Scar tissue is cirrhosis. Then, you know, we have a lot of blood flowing through the liver. Now the blood can't flow through the river because the liver's like leather. And so that's the number one indication for liver disease. And it's happening right now as we gain weight. And it's not something, you know, when you're young, you know, and you think you're invulnerable, you're like, well, you know, I won't get this till I get old. Okay, so let's say we'll call 65 old. Okay, so let's say you're 65. You think it just appeared? No, you've been working on it for years. You've been working on the fat, the cholesterol in your arteries for years, right as we speak.
So there, again, we go back to, you know, these are some of the things that your healthcare practitioner should be asking you about. We talked about, you know, family history. We talk about your history. You're disclosing things about your past, which you did in your teens and your 20s and your 30s, and what you seem to be doing more recently in your, maybe in your late 30s, early 40s and beyond. So we need to be able to know that disclosures are really important to your healthcare practitioner. Secondly, we talked about the screenings. So the screenings can uncover a lot of this, including what we just talked about with respect to the liver, doing the calcium scoring with the CT. We talk about the implications for things like heart disease, diabetes, stroke, which is high blood pressure. We've covered some of that. What about lower respiratory disease? Women tend to have a higher incidence of chronic lower respiratory disease, things like asthma, COPD, sadly, lung cancer. Should we be either screening for that, or what should our HCPs be asking us about our lungs and our respiratory health?
Sure. So what we need to ask patients are things like, are you short of breath? Are you short of breath with exertion? Or are you short of breath at rest? So that's a big differentiating factor. Sometimes people will attribute their shortness of breath to, well, I'm deconditioned. And so when I go up the stairs, but the thing is, it could be that you're young and you have some lung issues and you can get away with it until you climb the stairs. Some people are diagnosed with asthma and they don't use their inhalers, and they need to use their inhalers, because the thing is, you need to get oxygen in. And if you're not getting oxygen, what happens is the heart has to work faster. The blood pressure may go up. Your heart rate goes up. And so anything that's wrong with your lungs that's not being dealt with will affect your heart. So you need to let your doctor know all the details about your breathing.
Last one, brain. Your brain. Alzheimer's, unfortunately, women tend to be those that suffer more disproportionately from cognitive decline, whether it's dementia or Alzheimer's. We're learning more about this every day. And there's some great books out there if you're interested. Dr. Lisa Moscone, I think I've mentioned this a couple times, has a book called The XX Brain. And she also has something called the menopause brain. But if you're not in menopause, XX brain, it's worth a read. But and the question is, Do we, should we know? How do we know? Going back to, is it genetics or is it some of the things that we've done to our bodies that may increase that cognitive decline? And just some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so we don't have a really good way to measure if you are going to be demented. I mean, there are tests now, they're controversial. They need to be ordered by the right people to be able to interpret them. But whatever you do for your lungs or your heart today, you're also doing for your brain. One thing that we're going to talk about in the future is the cardiometabolic syndrome. And that was a way to tie what happens to your heart. It's not just a heart thing, but it also depends on your sugar and your liver and your insulin resistance and so on. So think about this. This is something that happens in my office. It's not unusual. I'm talking to someone in her 60s or maybe even late 50s, and there's just a tiny, tiny little pause, and then she answers. And what I'm seeing is an absence of being able to comprehend what I'm saying. And I wouldn't say that the person has dementia, but I do have to wonder about cognitive impairment. Can you have, like, long before you would be demented, you can have various levels of cognitive impairment. So think about the blood vessels in your brain. Some of them are tiny. Now, we talk about the coronary arteries, which we can see on a CAT scan. So they're pretty big, right? That's maybe like a pencil, smaller than a pencil, but in diameter. And it takes a while to fill them up with the LDL cholesterol and build those plaques. But if you have tens of thousands of tiny arteries in your brain, they're not very thick. They're not very big, and they can easily fill up with cholesterol and what we call hardening of the arteries. And we have a lot of room in our brain to function when we've had an injury. But at a certain point, people start to slow down. And I think it's due to what we would call microvascular disease. Microvascular, tiny arteries, and filled with cholesterol, and no blood is flowing, oxygen is not flowing. And I think we all have that to some extent. And so how do we prevent that? Lower your LDL, get to a healthy weight, lower your blood pressure, keep your sugars down.
So these are great tips. We covered a lot of territory. And if you continue to tune in to the Love Mia Vita podcast, what you will learn are the different ways in which we can prevent some of these things from occurring. Catherine and other professionals that she and I interview during the Love Mia Vita podcast will talk about nutrition and diet, exercise, healthy eating. Obviously, it is about eating, but eating the right things. We also talk about different types of metabolic disorders. We've covered sleep in the past in more in-depth ways. So these are all tips. So today's podcast is really to cover what you should be asking your HCP, and in a bi-directional way, what your HCP should be asking you. So show up, disclose, come prepared. Don't expect your healthcare practitioner, who's probably very smart like Catherine, to be able to read your mind. At the moment, they haven't been trained to be mind readers. So, Catherine, any final points that you'd like to make before we conclude our podcast?
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about all the bad things that can go wrong. And I don't want people to feel neurotic and that, or make people more neurotic, because remember, in conventional Western medicine, we are disease-based. We're not health-based. We're like, here are all the bad, terrible things that can happen to you. I'd like you to think about the good things that can happen to you when you sleep, and when you sleep well, when you eat well, when you're at a healthy weight, when you exercise, and when you feel like you have so much energy. And we all have hard jobs, and we all take care of people at home. And so it's not easy to be our best self. But I would like you to approach this with the thought that your goal is to be the best person you can be.
Absolutely. It's great advice. Make sure that you take control of the things that you do have under your control. As you said, you can't do anything about your genes. They are your genes. And you can't do anything about what happened in the past. But you can do something about the future. And that's why we're here. We want you to be thinking about the future, living your best life. And it's the prime of your life. So attack it with all the fervor and all the enthusiasm you can muster, because you have a long way to go.
You sure
do. And with that, I will conclude the Love Mia Vita podcast. I want to thank all of you for joining us, especially my co-host, Dr. Catherine Sharif. Remember to visit our website, fempharma.com, and check us out on social media, on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you, Catherine. And thank you, all of you. And remember to love Mia Vita, my life.
Lovely. Okay. Thank you, Jerry.